Hello, and welcome back to Texas Tech Health Check from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. I'm your host, Melissa Whitfield. We want you to get healthy and stay healthy with help from evidence-based advice from our physicians, healthcare providers, and researchers. You may have heard about encephalitis being a possible threat in certain areas of the world, but if you're like me, you might not know much else. Well, just because we hear about it happening somewhere else, it doesn't mean we're immune to it here. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Walter Duarte, a neurologist with the School of Medicine. He explains what encephalitis is, how you could possibly get it, who is at risk, what the symptoms are, and why early detection is key to effective treatment. Hello, Dr. Duarte. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your expertise, and what you do here at the Health Sciences Center?
Yeah, of course. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. My name is Walter. Duarte is my last name. I'm one of the new faculties here in Texas Tech. I did my medical school back in Guatemala. I had the luck to do my residency here in Lubbock, Texas, in neurology. And then I moved to Houston for 2 years for neurocritical care training.
Well, again, like I said, welcome to our podcast. We're happy to have you.
Thank you so much.
So a lot that I've seen in the news recently is people getting measles. And when they say measles, they bring up encephalitis. But encephalitis isn't exclusive to measles, right?
Correct.
Can you tell us what is encephalitis?
Yes, of course. So encephalitis, you know, basically is brain swelling or brain inflammation. It can be for multiple things. You know, the most frequent is an infection, as you pinpointed, like measles, for example. But there are other reasons or other causes for encephalitis. But in summary, it's the swelling of the brain.
What are the other causes?
So as I mentioned, you know, most of them, they are like infectious related. It could be a virus. It could be a bacteria as well. And I will say that's around 50% of the cases of encephalitis that we see. There is another 30% of patients with encephalitis that we call autoimmune related, meaning your body is going to create an antibody that is going to attack your own brain. Okay, so that's 30% of cases. And then we have a 20% of cases that we don't really know what exactly is causing the brain inflammation. So I will say those are the main two big ones, infection and autoimmune. And I think we're going to be talking about them through the conversation.
Can we prevent it?
Yes, we can. You know, and again, I think it depends. But talking about encephalitis that is infectious, we have forms or tools that can be helpful to prevent it, yes. For example, vaccines, right? If you get your measles vaccine when you're little, that's a way to prevent, you know, infections down the line and hopefully in the future a brain infection, for example. Other big ways to prevent it, I will say, since most of the reasons or the causes of the encephalitis are viruses or bacteria, if you have good hygiene, also that can help to prevent, for example, the spread of the viruses or the bacteria. So that's a good way also to prevent it. If we talk about, you know, the autoimmune encephalitis, there might not be a way to prevent, you know, getting that problem because that's, I mean, a reaction of your body into your brain. But at least what you can do is we can provide medications as a physician, and then you can prevent other episodes or new episodes, what we call relapses of the disease. So, you know, those are the most frequent ways to try to prevent them.
Who is likely to get encephalitis?
You know, I will say everyone can get encephalitis. Of course, there are some populations that might be at higher risk. So, for example, elderly people, patients, you know, about 50 years of age, that might not be elderly, but, you know, about 50 years of age, they can have more encephalitis for herpes virus, for example. Babies less than 3 years old, herpes virus as well, but the type 2, you know, that can be transmitted by the mother. From the autoimmune perspective, we know that maybe young females are more susceptible to get autoimmune problems. Probably you have heard of other diseases, you know, like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, maybe those are kind of autoimmune diseases that, you know, sometimes kind of the same way you can get autoimmune encephalitis, this population can get this problem as well.
How is it diagnosed and how is it treated? Is there a cure?
You know, as a physician, we always go by, we use this kind of, you know, like protocol. So we use, you know, the history, we use the clinical exam, we go by laboratories. For encephalitis, more in particular, we want to know and we want to do a cerebrospinal fluid analysis that's going to give us a lot of information of, you know, what type of inflammation, if there is a virus or not in your brain. And then lastly, we use brain imaging, you know, a CT scan, a brain MRI to see if we can locate any particular spot where the inflammation could be happening. So, you know, talking briefly about these multiple tools that we use for diagnosis, from the history, you know, so people can also be aware of it. Most of the patients, they may have recent respiratory infection or maybe a recent gastrointestinal or diarrhea, for example, in the previous few weeks. Most of these patients are going to present with fevers, headaches, and then some type of neurological problem, meaning, you know, they are found to be disoriented. They have weakness on one side of their body. They can have seizures. They have some memory loss. So those, you know, neurological factors or deficits combined with headaches and fevers, those are like a red flag for us. So that's from, you know, from the history. From the physical exam, of course, you know, the patient, you may find them to be altered. They may have neck pain, neck stiffness. And then, as I had mentioned earlier, you know, the cerebrospinal analysis is extremely important. So we're going to check for viruses. We're going to check for bacteria. We will check also for to see if there is any antibody that we can pinpoint on that analysis. You know, frequently we are able to find them, to pinpoint what exactly is causing. Sometimes we don't. And we just go by indirect findings. For example, elevated white blood cells in the blood or in the spinal sample. So we can try to make, you know, like we can make a case and try to decide which etiology or which cause is making the problem based on those studies. And yeah, and always, you know, the brain images are extremely useful. For example, herpes virus, which is one of the most frequent infectious etiologies, that usually will affect, for example, your temporal lobe. So I think it's a combination of, you know, of information that will help you to do the diagnosis.
These symptoms, do they develop in the short term, or do they develop over time?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So for infectious problems, right, again, for viruses or bacteria or even fungal infections that can cause brain swelling or brain infection, most of them are acute, you know, maybe within weeks, I will say, or sometimes, you know, fairly rapid, a couple of days that the symptoms develop. As I mentioned before, some of the patients may develop, you know, may have a respiratory infection before, maybe a couple of weeks before those acute changes. Okay. Now, when we see a case that has been slowly kind of building up those symptoms, meaning a couple of months or maybe, you know, 4 weeks, that has slowly, that family has seen some, you know, like weird behaviors for the last 4 weeks or 8 weeks, and then recently has been worsening, those cases, we call them subacute, right? So they're not super rapid. But those cases, they pinpoint more towards an autoimmune problem, more than an infection problem. So that's another, you know, kind of way and things that we as neurologists, we need to ask family, you know, how quick did the symptoms happened, so they can, that will help us to guide our treatment.
Well, then what can we do for loved ones with encephalitis?
Yeah, you know, there is so much we can do for these patients. First of all, I think rapid recognition of their symptoms, it's very important. As I mentioned, you know, try to get the red flags in your mind. Somebody who is having neurological changes, behavior, changes on the level of consciousness, for example, on top of fevers and headache, you know, that's something that you want to bring to the emergency room as soon as possible. And I'm making a big emphasis on it because the earlier you get them to the ED and the earlier you give them treatment, that's going to be, you know, the faster we're going to treat the patient and we'll be able to improve their outcomes. A lot of these patients are going to have neurological deficits, right? You know, I don't know if you have heard, some of them may develop seizures, some of them long-term, depending on the severity of the disease. They can have memory problems, movement problems, right? Weakness. So a lot of the treatment at that point is going to come to rehabilitation. So, you know, the loved ones making sure that they're getting, you know, the physical therapy on time, as frequent as recommended, giving them the medication that they need to take, you know, on a regular basis for seizure medications, you know, for what else, for fever, for pain, for example. Those are the things that I will, you know, recommend and tell the family that they will have to work hard on the next few days so they can get their loved one better.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I think I will just, you know, highlight the recognition of the symptoms, you know, be aware of what the symptoms are so the family members can act as quickly as possible. Second, I will say, you know, with the aging population, with new cancer treatments, for example, new medication that will suppress the immune system, we're seeing more and more cases of encephalitis of any type. So, you know, just for the, you know, population in general and also for the physicians to be aware of, you know, of this very important diagnosis so we can try to improve our outcomes, as I mentioned. And, you know, lastly, I will say just, you know, thank you for bringing, you know, this topic, you know, this awareness. I think it's very important for us as physicians and for the people to be aware of the encephalitis cases.
Well, thank you for coming on and shedding some light on encephalitis and explaining what it is and what to look out for. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course, no, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Texas Tech Health Check. Make sure to subscribe or follow wherever you listen to podcasts. This information is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek immediate medical advice from your physician or your healthcare provider for questions regarding your health or medical condition. Texas Tech Health Check is brought to you by Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and produced by Tierra Castillo, Susanna Cisneros, Mark Hendricks, Kay Williams, Hope Caperton, and me, Melissa Whitfield.